Trump and Russia, the rhetoric and the reality, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's been a wild week for Russia experts, like this Moscow-based analyst who's spending lots of time just setting people straight.
Not everything bad that now takes place in the United States of America is somehow a nefarious Russian plot.
Also today, the war in Syria has fueled hatred. So for this Syrian writer, there was only one way to go.
I couldn't stand this situation. I couldn't stand my own anger. And it was satire was the way to deal with it for me.
And teenagers across the globe are taking to the streets tomorrow for action on climate change.
By the time we're older, the planet is going to be at the worst it's ever been.
That's just some of the stories on today's Spin of the World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It was a week of clarifications and re-clarifications and re-re-clarifications. It was the week of would versus wouldn't, double negatives. I'm talking, of course, about Monday's press conference in Helsinki between Presidents Trump and Putin and all the fallout and walk back that's come after. I can't recall a Newsweek dominated by just a few minutes from a press conference. Most of the media coverage has focused on the rhetoric. And yes, what presidents say is crucial, but what's the reality behind the rhetoric? Joining me now are Anna Aratunian. She's in Moscow and is an analyst with the International Crisis Group. We've also got Chris Miller from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, just outside of Boston. Let's just start with a comment from President Trump. This is from a couple of months ago.
There has been nobody tougher on Russia than President Donald Trump.
Anna, let's take the case of Ukraine and Russia's annexation of Crimea. I mean, Trump has upped sanctions on Russia and did send military assistance to Ukraine. That's more than Obama did. So doesn't Trump have a point there?
Well, that's the trouble here, is that we don't know, and we don't know what exactly to expect. I think that one of the results of this summit has been precisely this divergence of rhetoric versus reality, optics versus reality. In terms of optics, I've argued before that this is very good for Putin because he made himself look very much adult and very much predictable in comparison to Trump. However, the rhetoric that we heard from Trump has a tendency to muddy and basically undermine whatever activity is going on in terms of real policy to Russia. So we don't really know if the president of the United States uses a state summits with a U.S. adversary, meets with Putin, and then uses that summit as a platform to criticize his own political establishment. Politically, how does that make him look to the said adversary? And politically, how does that make him look to the political establishment? And basically, I have a major question about the extent to which that the Kremlin can now rely on any agreements that did or did not come out of this summit, given that whatever Trump said now might be swept away in this backlash that he's facing back at home in the States.
Yeah, I mean, the rhetoric certainly does muddy things, and that's an interesting point you make, that it's not just muddying things for the American public and the American press, but also for Putin himself. Chris, if you just look at Ukraine, and if you're able to take the rhetoric out and kind of unmuddy things, how do you see it?
First off, it's impossible to take the rhetoric out because the rhetoric is so much of the reality. One question is, what does the president think U.S. policy towards Ukraine should be? And on the one hand, he's right in saying that he's armed the Ukrainians, which Obama wasn't willing to do. But at the same time, he barely mentioned Ukraine in the press conference with President Putin in Helsinki, even though that, at least before President Trump, has been one of the key sources of disagreements between Russia and the United States. So it's not quite clear what the president believes, because he has a different story each time he talks to the media about it. The other question is if it's true that the U.S. is taking a tougher policy today compared to what it was several years ago, is that due to the president or is that due to Congress? Because it's actually the U.S. Congress that has boxed in President Trump on the question of sanctions, for example. So sanctions are continuing today, not thanks to what the president's been doing, but thanks to the fact that Congress hasn't given him any choice.
Anna, what's the view from Moscow on this? Like, when you speak with Russians who follow U.S.-Russian relations, does U.S. pressure on Russia around Ukraine under Trump, does it worry them?
Well, the way that the Kremlin and the people around the Kremlin view the situation, and Putin has pretty much said this since the summit, is that all of the overtures, all of the nice overtures towards Russia are being made by Trump, whereas the bad things like the sanctions and the pressure, that's coming from Congress and the political establishment, and they are not nice people, as the Kremlin sees it. So from that perspective, Russia is going to kind of want to side with Trump. For instance, there was a statement by the Ministry of Defense in Russia that they're ready to intensify contacts with the U.S. General Staff on expanding the START Treaty, on cooperation in Syria. And there's a great deal of overtures now that the summit has happened in that regard. But again, given the mood with which Trump returned to Washington, given the huge amount of distrust about what went on behind those closed doors, let's say if this was any other president and such a deal had been on the table, there'd be nothing stopping the general staff of both countries. Okay, let's go ahead and talk.
Now, Syria was another topic that came up at the Helsinki press conference. Here's what Trump said.
The crisis in Syria is a complex one. Cooperation between our two countries has the potential to save hundreds of thousands of lives.
So Putin's comments on Syria also suggested a willingness to work with the U.S. and France and Turkey and Iran to alleviate human suffering and the refugee crisis in the region. But Chris Miller at Tufts, was this the start of a grand bargain that many Syria watchers were hoping for from this summit in Helsinki?
Well, probably not, in part because it isn't only President Trump who wanted to find a way to work with Russia in Syria. President Obama and his Secretary of State, John Kerry, also had hoped to find ways to work with Russia. And even when Trump was first beginning his time in the White House in early last year, there were efforts to find ways to cooperate with the Russians in Syria. The question always was and still remains, what does that mean, cooperate with the Russians in Syria? What particular are we going to give the Russians and what do we expect in return? And so far as I can tell, there's been really very little tangible progress in approaching a sense of what a trade-off would look like. You know, as the president said, the Syrian issue is complex and it's not just enough to want cooperation with Russia. You actually have to make some difficult trade-offs. And thus far, we haven't seen any details as to what those would actually mean.
Yeah. So on Syria, you see a clear gap between the rhetoric and the reality.
It's a gap that's existed for multiple years now, and there's no evidence that it's narrowing.
And Anna Arutunian, in Moscow, is there a sense that Putin's role in Syria now is one of a peacemaker?
That's certainly how Putin is trying to present himself in Syria. I think for Putin, this is very important to present, again, going back to this idea of Putin as the adult in the room, kind of in Syria, that's the image he's been trying to project from the beginning, that, see, you people went in there, you didn't have a plan, you didn't have a strategy, you didn't know what you were doing, and now we've got the civil war. Well, here, we're going to come in and fix things for you. And it is cloaking that in this rhetoric of we are peacemakers, let's just quiet. We're also realistic about how the world works, and let's just quietly solve this and fight terrorism together.
There was this tweet from President Trump yesterday. The summit with Russia was a great success, except with the real enemy of the people, the fake news media. I look forward to our second meeting so that we can start implementing some of the many things discussed, including stopping terrorism, security for Israel, nuclear. There was also this intriguing moment in Helsinki where Trump said, we want to get rid of nukes in the world. And he seemed to suggest that Vladimir Putin agreed with him. Just help us understand for a moment, what is the risk from Russia now coming out of Helsinki? The general consensus is Helsinki empowered Putin. So just like in terms of nukes or anything else, pressure on the Baltics or even the Russian economy, Chris Miller, where does Helsinki leave us?
Well, I think nuclear is a great example. Under any other president, this would be a top issue for real substantive negotiations because there's a number of key arms control agreements between the United States and Russia, which are either currently falling apart or in the process of expiring in the next couple of years. And so on both sides, there's an interest in finding a way to extend them. But of course, President Trump hasn't done the legwork to begin those discussions, nor does he have the credibility with Congress or the United States people to make the sort of compromises that would be necessary to restore the arms control agreements that he's talking about. So he's mentioned nukes before in the context of relations with Russia. As early as a year ago, there's been no progress to date, and I wouldn't expect much progress over the next couple of years, just again, given the gap between the rhetoric and the reality that's marked his presidency.
So Anna, does Russia just keep building nukes and the U.S. the same?
Well, I think that's actually an area where they're going to reach some kind of agreement, because it's nice to have an agreement. It's nice to show something that, again, we're peacemakers. And also, is it really in Russia's best interest to keep building nukes? That's a big question. So I think that that's an easy win for both sides. Again, the trouble is there is political will on that. Problem is, you come away from something like Helsinki, and now there is just this deep distrust of whatever agreements were made behind these closed doors between Trump and Putin.
Yeah, it's got to be baffling. Trump did say in that tweet, "I look forward to our second meeting." So let me ask both of you, how do you view this latest idea of an invitation to Vladimir Putin to come to Washington in the fall? Good idea or bad idea? Anna?
I think, again, for this to succeed, for this to have any merit or substance whatsoever, there needs to be some sort of consensus about what Trump is. There needs to be a certain amount of trust between Trump and Congress and the rest of the political establishment, because without that trust, bringing Putin over, sure, Putin loves optics. Optics are great. He would be quite happy to do that. It would make him look great. Substantively, nothing would come of it unless there is some, we're moving in a direction of more trust within the American establishment, because without that trust, no matter what they talk about, it's just going to be seen as compromised by whatever is assumed about Trump's and Putin's relationship.
Chris, what do you think about a second Trump-Putin summit?
If you look historically at presidential summits between the U.S. and Russia, they've worked when both presidents started out with more hardline positions and used the summits to compromise, and then took their compromises home to their people and sold them as a necessary deal. But in this case, we've got a U.S. president who's starting out from a position of looking soft on Russia to the American people. And as a result, it's not clear to me that another conversation with Putin will change that perception. And so it's not also clear that a conversation will allow him to do any deals that would be accepted by either Congress or the American people in general as a good deal for the United States.
So before I let you go, I just need to ask you, what's it like to be a Russia analyst these days? Because you guys have to be getting asked all sorts of questions, but isn't the picture just muddier and muddier and the answers more elusive than ever? Chris?
It is, and it's being a Russia analyst has become being a Trump analyst recently, which is something that I'm less skilled at than understanding Russia.
What about you, Anna?
Well, I'm based in Moscow, so there's all sorts of yes, it is very muddy, and I don't just say that because it's been raining, but it's muddy in the sense that we don't really have a clear sense of the red lines we're operating with on either side. We know that there's a confrontation between Russia and the West, and we know that it's going to be very, very difficult to reconcile any sort of positions, because sides are just on many conflicts, they're operating in entirely different realities, especially on Ukraine. And I think that these misunderstandings, and we have to understand that the Kremlin really does genuinely feel misunderstood by the rest of the world, whether or not there is actual basis for them, to what extent that's the Kremlin's fault, that is this need to operate in these often contradictory realities. It's sometimes frustrating. And another thing is, I get a lot of requests from the United States for questions about that are actually about America. They're posed to me as a Russia analyst. I'm like, this is your own homegrown stuff, guys. I know that the Kremlin meddled. I know that this happened. But look, this is not everything that now happens, not everything bad that now takes place in the United States of America is somehow a nefarious Russian plot. And that kind of discourse is a little bit worrying.
Contradictory realities. That is the reality. Anna Arutunian in Moscow is an analyst with the International Crisis Group, and Chris Miller from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University here in Boston. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Syria is not a place that seems ripe for satire. The war has gone on there for years. As many as 400,000 Syrians have died. Several million more have fled. But it's precisely those very depressing facts that prompted a Syrian, Jim Sin, to get his voice heard through satire. The World's Carol Hills reports.
Yeah! Boom! That's Jim Sin imitating the sound of a bomb falling on Syria. Boom. Sounds pretty basic, but there's more to it. That's James Seen in character, in Arabic. His satire is all about his voice. He's used it to create four characters who chatter, bicker, complain, sometimes abuse each other, and who once in a great while express the tiniest bit of hope about their country. James Seen is a pen name. For security reasons, he can't reveal his real name, but he's a Syrian who's emotionally battered by what's happened to his country. And he's mad.
Every time I get into conversation or any discussion about the situation in Syria, I get very angry.
And speaking in the voice of his characters and posting his audio online allow him to agonize out loud.
So anger is the primary reason to choose another way of expressing things rather than escalate. I couldn't stand this situation. I couldn't stand my own anger. And it was satire was the way to deal with it for me.
As you can hear, Jim Seen speaks very good English, but he records his audio satire in Arabic because he wants to speak to other Syrians. And his chosen format is also very Syrian. That's the signature tune from Sabr and Sabrge, a comedic radio play that Jim Seen listened to when he was growing up in Damascus in the 1960s and 70s. It's about a husband and wife whose names, Sabr and Sabrge, come from the Arabic word for patience. The show is basically a dialogue between the two of them as they try to be patient with what married life throws at them.
وين كنت سهران امبارح؟
ما قلت لك عندي شغل إضافي المساء؟
بس أنا اتصلت بالتليفون على الدائرة.
Jim Seen loved the simplicity of Sabr and Sabrge, just two people talking. So back in 2011, with Syria hovering between peaceful unrest and civil war, he started tinkering with his voice and his iPhone, and in early November of that year, he posted a one-minute audio piece. One character asks the other what he's doing. The other guy says he's protesting. The first guy keeps asking why, and the second guy finally answers, I'm pretending that everything is fine. It's a play on words. The Arabic verb for protest comes from the verb to pretend. Jim Seen loves to play with the Arabic language. A few weeks later, Jim Seen debuted two more characters. Jim Seen calls his series of online audio plays the Chronicles of the Pressure Cooker. The pressure cooker, of course, being Syria.
There was a lid that was holding things inside. Things were kept in a pressure cooker. And in one of the first recordings that I made in late 2011, I said, you know, it might explode any time if we keep turning on the heat.
Things did explode. And ever since, Jim Seen has used the voices of his characters to variously hope, imagine, harumph, shout, or cry as his country has been shredded by civil war. In one episode, a character named Tariq asks his sidekick to try to guess the sounds of the different bombs they hear falling on Damascus. It's a game, but then it turns serious as they remind themselves that the bombs are real, and they start to imagine what's happening to the people the bombs are falling on. When I spoke to Jim Seen, I asked him if he would introduce his characters to me in character. I am Tariq Bourie, he says. I worked in the theater. My dreams are very jumbled, but I had a dream of leaving Syria. I did leave, but I went back. I dream of leaving again, but I don't want to leave.
Each one of these characters speaks in a way, speaks in a dialect that you just don't hear very much anymore.
Elias Muhana teaches comparative literature at Brown University.
It sounds like the way that my grandparents spoke. It's a very rich form of Syrian Arabic expressions, proverbs, things that I often have to look up because nobody says these things anymore. So I was at first just drawn to that. I thought, who is this person who's making these very funny, very sophisticated commentaries on what's happening in Syria right now?
Muhana, who grew up in Lebanon, suspects that the Tariq character is sort of a stand-in for Jim Seen.
He's, somebody who used to work in the theater. He was a lighting designer, kind of freelance, has sort of maybe leftist politics, but he's not dogmatic about them. He's something of an idealist, but he's also a realist. There's something bitter about his reflections.
Tariq's buddy is Kablanini, which roughly translates the bottom of the glass bottle. Basically, he's called Coke bottle glasses.
مرحبا أنا كابلانيني. بشتغل الشغل اللي موجود. يعني آخر مرة آخر فترة كنت عم بشتغل على تاكسي.
He's saying, my name is Kabalanini. I do odd jobs. Recently, I've been working as a cab driver. My ultimate dream is to have gas and running water 24 hours a day. Sometimes I dream that I wake up and there's no sound of missiles or bombs being dropped. Muhana says the character of Kabalanini is a very familiar Syrian type.
He's very emotional. He's somebody who gets sucked into these protests and demonstrations and swings from one pole to the other. So he's maybe somebody that many ordinary Syrians would identify with because he's not very rational all the time, whereas Tarek is really very cold and calculating.
Jimsin's other pair of characters include a gruff Assad regime supporter, basically a security goon.
Hey, ana dabit amin. Wismi, ante ma dakhalak fi.
I'm a security officer, he says. My name is none of your business. Anyway, it should stay secret. All you need to know is that I'm protecting you from terrorism.
His foil is a put-upon meek guy named Mulezem Zift, or Ziftar, which roughly translates Lieutenant Zero, or Lieutenant Nothing.
اسمي زفت العيشة وأنا ملازم وبشتغل بالأمن وعم بشتغل عن هذا.
My name is Ziftar, he says. I work for an officer who's anonymous. I don't dare talk about my dreams.
Ziftar, or Lieutenant Zero, comes across as weak and spineless, but his character really exists to illustrate what a buffoon the security officer is. Jimsin fan Elias Muhana says the satire works because it's by a Syrian directed at Syrians, and it genuinely reflects Syria. The characters are not paper cutouts designed to deliver a particular message. They're recognizable types who talk and argue the way people actually talk and argue in places like Syria and Lebanon.
When I go back to the Middle East and get into conversations with taxi drivers or the dentist or people that you just have everyday political conversations with, they're different from here. Like, in a way, I feel like we avoid politics in the U.S. We don't have long political conversations. And when we do, it's with people with whom we already agree. Whereas I often have long conversations with people who have a completely different worldview than I do. And we're not screaming at each other and calling each other bigots or backward or hicks or whatever.
Jimsin's audio satire is layered and nuanced. At its core, it's a Syrian bereft by the loss of his country.
The more you touch people's feelings rather than ideas, the more you can get reaction from them. You need to touch the way people feel to make any change, even if it's very, very small. And my way of doing this, the way I found, is satire.
Jimsin is trying to carve meaning out of the tragedy of his country. His satire is in the form of a dialogue, yet it's a poignant comment on the lack of any dialogue going on in Syria. You can learn more about Jimsin, and if you understand Arabic, there are links to his audio satire at PRI.org. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Teenage Macedonians were making money putting out fake political news during the 2016 U.S. elections. Just teens having fun. Well, there's more to the story.
So we had Americans working for a Macedonian to write about U.S. politics. It's pretty wild.
That story. Also, who gets to define when world history begins? That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you're a kid in a U.S. public high school, or you have a kid in a public high school, like I do, you're probably familiar with AP, or Advanced Placement Classes. Across America, millions of students take AP classes every year to prepare for a test that could get them college credit. In May, the nonprofit company that writes the AP curriculum decided to change its world history class. Pre-colonial history is now gone. For AP students, world history now begins in the year 1200. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, that's been very controversial.
AP World History covered about 10,000 years when Paige Becker took it last year in Lady Lake, Florida.
For me, it wasn't too much because I loved the course, but I know that not everybody's a history lover.
She had to read about 30 pages every night, analyze documents, write essays, and take lots of tests to prepare for the big exam.
So I had just taken the AP World exam, and I was going on there to see, like, stuff about when test scores would be released. And I saw something about the new changes to AP World.
She saw that the College Board, the nonprofit that runs the advanced placement curriculum and exam, Becker saw that they were going to change AP World History so it would start in 1450.
And I was like, wait, no, there's more to history than that. Because that change would make it so that everything was cut out, basically, before colonization from Europe.
A lot of teachers reacted that way, too.
I will not continue a sentence if I'm interrupted. So you're welcome to interrupt me if you like, but I won't continue if that's the way we're going to behave tonight. I just won't.
At a conference in June, they confronted College Board Vice President Trevor Packer, a former AP World History teacher from Oakland, California, Amanda Doamiral, told Packer he was sending the wrong message to students of color.
Right, the people in power in our country already are telling those same students that their history, that their present, that their future doesn't matter. And by you making this decision, you are going along with that. Their histories matter. Their histories don't start at slavery.
Packer said he was offended by that and by people who suggested the College Board's change to AP World History was financially motivated because everyone would have to buy their new materials. Packer said he was just being realistic about how much information kids could absorb in 1 year to prep for a $90 AP exam.
If we wanted to increase revenues, we can make a very simple move. It would be to take the two college courses that comprise AP World History and create two separate AP World History exams, Part 1 and Part 2.
But that's what they ended up doing.
There's no longer going to be one big AP World History class. Rather, it's going to be split up into AP Modern History and AP Ancient History.
Paige Becker and another student in New Jersey, Dylan Black, had started a change.org petition, and more than 12,000 people signed, asking Packer not to change AP World History.
I guess I just annoyed him enough that he finally contacted me.
The two students got on the phone with Packer, and he told them the College Board had decided to change course. The board would create another AP class to cover history before 1200, and the existing AP World History class would start at 1200 instead of 1450.
And we both agreed that it was a much more acceptable change because you can go more into detail about them rather than keeping them really like basic and general.
The College Board says it won't benefit financially from the changes. A spokesperson said no one was available for an interview, but she pointed me in the direction of others who'd talk.
My name is Peter Stearns. I teach history at George Mason University, and at various points I've been deeply involved with the AP World History program.
Stearns says starting at 1200 isn't ideal, but at least this way students will learn about a few cultures before they were conquered.
It's important to be realistic. I support the change because I think they're trying to satisfy a number of different constituencies, and I have no reason to suspect their motives.
But Stearns isn't sure how many schools will take the time or resources necessary to offer the new AP World Ancient History class.
I'm very skeptical that many schools are going to jump into the development of this second course.
And that means many AP teachers across the country remain skeptical that the College Board should be making any changes to AP World History. Eric Beckman's taught the class for 5 of his 30 years in St. Paul, Minnesota schools.
AP World History had a lot of potential to be a tool to interrupt institutionalized racism. And now this diminishes that.
Beckman says cutting back on the time period AP World History covers doesn't make sense because the class is supposed to look at long-term trends in how history unfolds. And now Beckman says the existing AP World History class in schools won't cover things like the Golden Age of Islam, the rise of mathematics in India, the innovation of Chinese dynasties, or the great West African trading kingdoms.
You know, when, you know, the president referred to the homes of some of my students as shitholes, and it's like, I just want to publicly say that I'm glad your families are here. And it's a lot easier to say that having spent time talking about some of the golden ages in those parts of the world.
When you grow up as a person of color in this country and you learn about your history as beginning with oppression, it paints a picture for you that your history has always been one of oppression. And then it normalizes that. And then it becomes, that's the way things have always been, and that's the way things will always be.
Amanda Doamiral, the teacher you heard earlier in a testy exchange with Trevor Packer, she says she still doesn't feel like educators are being heard.
That's exactly the same issue that's happening across the country in what, you know, you name the issue. It's like people are just frustrated and like can't get things done, can't get things changed because we're not being listened to.
Paige Becker, the Florida student who's going to be a junior in the fall, thinks teachers might be overreacting. She says the creation of a new AP Ancient World History class solves many issues, even though it may take a few years before the course shows up in schools.
All these teachers are upset about it. They're like, oh, that's so Eurocentric. Well, it's AP Modern History. They're not trying to say it's world history anymore. That's the main thing I was having an issue with. AP Ancient History is going to be happening.
Becker says the fact that the College Board listened to concerns and made a change, that shows her that they really do have students' best interests at heart. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
President Trump loves to talk about fake news. He uses the term dismissively about stories he just doesn't like. But there are many people engaged in producing actual fake news, like some teenagers in Macedonia. They were writing online stories supporting then-candidate Donald Trump during the 2016 election. For those teens, it was about making money through advertisements. The plan worked really well. But turns out it wasn't just a bunch of Macedonian teenagers having a laugh and trying to make a few bucks. BuzzFeed recently co-reported that the fake news sites were actually launched by a well-known Macedonian attorney, a man with ties to American partners, including a candidate running now for the state assembly in Nevada. The Macedonian attorney's name is Tale Arsov, and one of the reporters who broke this story is BuzzFeed's Craig Silverman. So tell us who Tale Arsov is.
So Tale is, conveniently, he's actually a media lawyer. During the previous government, which was rather authoritarian in its tendencies, he was one of the few lawyers who would actually defend journalists. So he was seen as someone who was very favorable to real reporting and real news. And yet, at the same time he was doing that kind of work, he was running a group of websites and Facebook pages that were pushing stories that were often false and really helped kick off this trend of U.S. politics sites run for Macedonia.
So you describe Arsov as the godfather of U.S. political sites in Macedonia. He and his brother launched a site called USA Politics Today back in September of 2015. Was that like the first fake news site?
As we went back through the data that I had gathered for our first story, which was published a week before Election Day in 2016, we looked back and we saw that that was the first one that we could find. And on top of that, we also were getting information from sources at Macedonian intelligence and other agencies who revealed to us that there is an investigation underway to try and understand the origin of these sites. And they have a list of about 20 people they're looking at, including one Russian. And Tale Arsov was on that list. And then when we compared it to our data, we saw that he was the first and the earliest site that we could find.
But just to be clear, he's not Russian.
He is not Russian. He is a Macedonian lawyer.
So, Craig, how much does this new investigation by BuzzFeed and your partners contradict the previous narrative of village kids in Macedonia happily making thousands of dollars by posting fake news on social media?
Well, I think it adds some really important new information about how it started, which has always been a big question. You know, the truth is those teens and young men were still doing that. They did launch those sites. But the question was always, how did they think to do that? We knew that there were already people there making money from English language websites, but nobody was doing politics. So why did politics start? That was always the question. And the answer now is that Tale, because of his fandom for American politicians, decided to really start that off. And what happened is a chain reaction where other people in Macedonia saw that he, Tale and his brother were doing this, they were making money. And so other people started to do that. And so really we have that missing piece of the puzzle that's really important.
Now, this story connects right back to here in the U.S. because, as you reported, Arsov reached out to Americans Ben Goldman and Paris Wade, founders of the hyperpartisan conservative site Liberty Writers News. Tell us who Goldman and Wade are.
So Ben Goldman and Paris Wade are two Americans, young guys in their 20s, who really rose to fame thanks to an article about them in the Washington Post published in late November of 2016. So again, we have this scenario where Trump wins and people start to try and understand this new information ecosystem. And Washington Post did this profile that really showed how these guys were just kind of living in this rented house, making up crazy headlines to go with stories, running really partisan content. They insist that they didn't publish anything that was fake. And so these guys became kind of the poster children in some ways for hyperpartisan news. And that was just a few weeks after we had done our story about, you know, the young man in Macedonia spreading fake stories. And it turns out that, in fact, the two things were connected. These two guys in 2016 got in touch with Tale via Facebook, and they started sharing each other's content on each other's Facebook pages. And Paris Wade, in fact, wrote over 40 articles for Talei Arsov's site. So we had Americans working for a Macedonian to write about U.S. politics. It's pretty wild.
Craig Silverman with BuzzFeed, thanks for being with us again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
From fake news to real news now, the real news we couldn't get to this week. With a constant drumbeat of Trump and Putin, a lot of stories got sidelined. These are stories that are pretty darn obscure, and you probably haven't heard about them anywhere else. The BBC runs a news site called News from Elsewhere, and Alistair Coleman of BBC Monitoring is one of the writers, and he's with us to share some of his favorite stories from the past few days. Thank you so much for the relief, Alistair, from You Know What. I want to just start with a story from Uzbekistan that involves actress Amy Schumer. What's up there?
In Uzbekistan, one of the local television channels screened the Amy Schumer film, I Feel Pretty. And unfortunately, they left in one of the bedroom scenes from the film. And that's caused quite a lot of anger in conservative circles in the country there. So there's actually been calls for apologies and sackings over this.
Wow. So that's some of the fallout. Has Amy Schumer responded?
No, she hasn't. I don't think she even knows about this, to be honest.
That would surprise me if she did.
But three people who reviewed the film and should have edited out some scenes and some language, they have unfortunately lost their jobs after a social media campaign against the channel.
So, Alistair, let's go to North Korea, where Kim Jong-un has been going on inspection visits of various construction sites around the country. North Korean TV had some harsh words about the speed at which these construction projects are all coming along. That's North Korean newsreader Ri Chun-hee relating the news of a recent visit to a construction site by Kim Jong-un. What makes this newsworthy?
These visits are usually celebratory affairs. He turns up and everybody gathers around and has their picture taken with him, and it's all smiles. But Kim went to Singapore last month, so he's seen how beautiful the city is there and how well organized and how the economy is booming. And he's come home and he's seen building sites that have taken 17 years. He went to a hotel that's taken 6 years and they haven't even got plaster on the walls yet. And he's not very pleased with the way things have been going. And he's been telling local officials that they haven't got jobs for life anymore.
And then in New Zealand, a Shakespeare production is underway, but it's been causing controversy. How come?
Yes, there's a theatre there called the Pop-Up Globe, and their latest season is all about misuse of power. And one of them is Richard III, and another is the Taming of the Shrew. And they've both got all-male casts.
Uh-huh.
And if you know your Shakespeare, Taming of the Shrew is all about sexism and misogyny. And even though the original Shakespeare plays were played with all male casts in London in the 1500s, in the age of Me Too, it's seen that it's probably bad form to have just men playing these parts, especially of a very fiery woman.
How's the production company defending this production?
Well, they made a huge mistake, and they admit they've made a huge mistake by using the Me Too hashtag for their promotion. So they were promoting an all-male cast with a feminist campaign hashtag. They've noted that there was a huge campaign against this, and they've come back and said, yes, we made a mistake using the Me Too hashtags. We made a mistake casting only men. And they're going to reconsider their decision, and we may see some actresses treading the board for these two plays.
Finally, Alistair, let me ask you about something in your own backyard, something that's impacting you personally, the heat wave in the UK. What's that been like?
It's mad. I'm old enough to remember we had a summer in 1976, and I was 10 years old then, and all the grass died, and we ran out of water. And it's going that way now. Every single piece of grass I've seen is brown. I have heard rumours there may be rain today, and I've heard of people I know who've actually seen water falling from the sky.
Do the rain dance, Alistair.
Well, my wife's gone camping, so yes, it's bound to rain now.
Thanks very much for telling us about this news from elsewhere. It was very refreshing, even though the air in England is not right now. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
It was a revolution that got kids from around the globe traveling to Nicaragua and The Clash to write a song. Nearly four decades ago, on this day, the left-wing Sandinista rebels overthrew the dictatorship in Nicaragua. One of the heroes of that revolution, a young man named Daniel Ortega. He's now the president and has been leader of the country on and off since the 1980s. But many Nicaraguans believe Ortega has turned into a dictator himself. Political violence erupted in Nicaragua 3 months ago, and hundreds of people have been killed. The Organization of American States is now condemning government forces there for human rights abuses. Delphine Schrank has been covering developments in Nicaragua for Reuters. So this all started back in April, Delphine, with protests over pension reforms. Basically, Ortega was going to reduce retirement packages, but then scrapped those reforms. But the anger had been unleashed. Now we're hearing about rebel-held territories. So bring us up to speed. What should we even be calling this conflict now?
That's a good question. I think people there can call it an insurrection. You could call it a version of a revolution. But what is very clear is that since April 18th, the beginning of protests against those pension reforms you mentioned, you've had sometimes hundreds of thousands of people in the streets protesting Ortega at its height.
And now I hear there's a new law in Nicaragua sentencing anyone who protests to 20 years in prison. Who are the two sides in this conflict now?
So to begin with, you had students coming out into the streets, students and farmers who were protesting this pension reform, but basically who were fed up with what they call the consolidation of power of President Daniel Ortega, who, as you pointed out, had been a hero, but in his recent term of office since 2006 has steadily consolidated power. The perception is he's manipulated the media, he's manipulated the judiciary, and this turned into a sort of nationwide conflagration of students, of economists, of academics, of farmers, against loyalists of President Daniel Ortega, who include the police and a lot of armed plainclothes civilians who people call paramilitaries there. And this has escalated into very violent clashes more or less every day. And the death toll has risen to almost 300 and many, many more wounded.
So it sounds like hardcore Ortega loyalists versus kind of almost everybody else.
Yes, that's certainly the perception from inside the streets. There's a very, very broad-based opposition to Ortega.
There were peace talks that Catholic officials were mediating, I understand. What happened to those?
So those have been on and off. The Catholic Church has been a mediator between the government representatives and this broad-based civilian movement who have been in opposition to Ortega. But when they have felt that the government has been effectively using this as a sort of delaying tactic, they've suspended the talks.
So right now you're in Honduras, a major source of migrants of the U.S. fleeing violence. I'm just curious, has the violence in Nicaragua been sending Nicaraguans fleeing?
Yes, indeed. I was speaking to representatives of the United Nations, UNHCR, that works with refugees in southern Mexico just yesterday, and they were saying they're starting to see Nicaraguans appearing in southern Mexico. That's quite surprising. Normally, the numbers are of Hondurans, El Salvadorians, and Guatemalans. Nicaragua until now had been relatively stable. These recent events have caused, I think, people to start to think about that.
Delphine Schrank is a Reuters chief correspondent for Mexico and Central America. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Here in the U.S., a group of young environmentalists scored a victory in court today. They're suing the U.S. government, arguing that federal energy policies are violating their civil rights by contributing to climate change. A federal appeals court in San Francisco rejected the government's latest effort to dismiss the case. And here's another example of young leadership on the environment. This weekend, teenagers will be taking to the streets in Washington and elsewhere to push for action on climate change. Organizers are calling their movement This Is Zero Hour, and they've recruited other young people from around the world to join them. From our Livable Planet desk, here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
Kibariti Majuto lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's so obvious to him why young people need to lead the fight against climate change, he almost laughs when I ask him about it.
Definitely, young people are the most at risk from climate change. If we just keep going as usual, like, oh, it's just normal, and climate change is not real, I don't know if there will be a planet by the time I turn 40.
There's clearly some hyperbole there, but the 20-year-old college student does worry about the world that current leaders are leaving his generation. Majuto is on the organizing committee for tomorrow's main march in D.C. One of their big demands is that elected officials stop accepting money from fossil fuel companies.
It's sort of the same argument by the Parkland kids who were protesting against the NRA.
The youth climate march was in the works before the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, but organizers say they were inspired by the March for Our Lives earlier this year.
Essentially, we are both asking the same thing. Whether you are marching for your lives or marching for like a livable planet, we just don't want politicians to be held accountable by corporations. We want them to be held accountable by the people who elected them in power.
Majuto was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he knows a mining industry feeding Western markets has had a big environmental impact.
It has really shaped the way that I view climate issues. It's not just an American issue, but it's a global issue that we all as the world have got to address.
Because it's a global issue, the march's organizing team have reached out to young people worldwide who've planned sister marches in the UK, Kenya, Brazil, Germany, the Netherlands, Nigeria, and India. In India's drought-prone Rajasthan region, Ram Chaudhry says they're not marching tomorrow, but planting drought-resistant trees.
I'm organizing this plantation, tree planting. That is like a march for us.
Here in the U.S., younger people are more likely to worry about climate change than older folks. And they're also more likely to want the federal government to step in to limit greenhouse gas pollution. Bella Lack, the 15-year-old co-organizer of London's Climate March, says she sees the same trend in the UK.
By the time we're older, the planet is going to be at the worst it's ever been. So I think that my generation, I see in them a passion and a desire to protect it.
But many of Lack's generation can't even vote yet.
So this march is really the means of giving us a voice to speak up.
The world was captivated this spring when Parkland survivors lifted their voices. But months later, there's been no change in national gun legislation. Lack says she doesn't expect global climate policy to change overnight either.
We're already talking about the march next year because we realize that sometimes a singular event can't change people. But if they keep seeing that we do have optimism and hope, then maybe they'll change their ways and realize that we're serious about this.
Marches are scheduled for tomorrow in 21 U.S. cities. Organizers have spelled out lots of actions young people can take themselves, from buying less stuff to growing some of their own food, so they don't have to rely entirely on politicians to make a change. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And it's the weekend. You probably felt at times we wouldn't make it to Friday. Wouldn't. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.